Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we have a reoccurring guest back on. Jam Berger is here to talk about his recent paper on extremist construction of identity. It's a great piece. We will post a link to the actual full-length paper with this talk. But first of all, welcome back, JM.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun to be here.
Yes, and I'm actually glad to be here too. I had to take a little break from the Loopcast due to other commitments, but I'm back, so I'm excited to be doing the first show back with you.
Cool.
For our listeners who might not know of JM, and I would be surprised if you don't because he's had a lot going on in the last couple years, JM is an associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism, and he's also a researcher and analyst and a consultant. And his special focus is on extremist activities in the U.S. and groups' use of social media. He has also co-authored a critically acclaimed book called ISIS, The State of Terror with his co-author Jessica Stern. And he's also the author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. He's published a lot of other amazing and great reports. So we're just so happy to have you back on the show, JM.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So why don't we open up this talk with you telling us a bit about the inspiration for this paper and the background, because it's a really interesting topic. And when I first read it, I got very excited because this is a completely different way of looking at and tackling the idea of legitimacy and identity with extremist groups.
Well, that's what I like to hear. So I really... was thinking about a lot. I've been thinking about for many years now, what is extremism and how can we look at and study extremism without getting caught up in any particular kind of ideology. So, you know, for many years now, since 9/11, you know, most of the talk that we have about extremism has been focused on jihadi stuff. And there are people who work on white nationalism and work on, you know, other forms of extremism, but They're sort of separate, you know, factionalized areas, and people don't tend to cross over that much. So I really wanted to start thinking about this problem in a way that was more universal, because I feel like extremism is a field of study in its own, you know, and we've been approaching it as being kind of derivative of other fields. It's politics, it's religion, it's psychology. And you know, I over the course of a lot of years and having worked on not just on jihadi stuff, but also on sort of domestic right-wing extremism, I felt like that there was some value in trying to approach this from the perspective of asking what, you know, what qualities are sort of universal to extremist groups. And what structures and how can we start thinking about them in a way that helps us understand each individual separate piece.
So going deeper within this paper, what was your methodology for this great piece?
Well, I wanted to approach this looking at texts. So I've been working a lot with the, as you mentioned, the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague, and they've been standing up a project called the Strategic Counterterrorism Communications Project. And so we've been doing a lot of work on propaganda and messaging, and how do you do strategic messaging that counters terrorist narratives. And in the course of that, you know, that's really kind of taken off, and I've been very fortunate to work with a great team there. And in particular, I've been really following closely the work of Dr. Hororo Ingram, who's another fellow with ICCT, and he and I have been sort of writing papers that you know, you can sort of see one of us takes a piece of the other ones and then takes off in an unexpected direction. And so his most recent piece had been discussing a way to approach counter-messaging and understanding propaganda through linkages. So his premise is that concepts can be linked. And so he did this in a very high-level way. So, you know, the high-level sort of proposition he put forward is that extremists link an out-group to a crisis, and then they link an in-group to the solution. So the crisis, you know, is linked to the in-group. It afflicts the in-group, and then the in-group provides the solution, and the solution affects the out-group. And so what he is proposing is that we, you know, think about when we're doing messaging to counterterrorism, that we do it, you know, we try and attack those linkages. We try and dissolve those linkages and build new ones. So what I did is sort of take that idea and make it much more granular. And so I approached a large body of extremist texts, and I decided to use Christian Identity, the source material behind the white nationalist group Christian Identity, is the basis for this, because there's a tremendous number of texts to work with over the course of a long period of time. And what I wanted to do was kind of twofold. I wanted to map linkages of concepts, so go beyond just like crisis and in-group, but really like map very specific kinds of linkages inside those categories, was the first thing. And then the second thing is that I wanted to do something that sort of dealt with the problem of identity and extremism, because that really was inspired by watching the 2016 election and looking at a lot of the definitions and concepts and political rhetoric around identity in the United States that I was concerned about when I watched it, and I wanted to do something that would be relevant to that.
So why don't you tell us and our listeners a little bit about in-groups and out-groups, just in case someone's coming from a completely different background or field and they might not know exactly in the context what this means.
Sure. The terminology comes from something called social identity theory, which is a way of looking at how groups interact. And so you have, when you look at how people sort of define their own identity and then define the identities of others, what you see is that you will have an in-group, which is the group that you belong to. So I'm an American, so other Americans are in my in-group. You have an out-group, and that out-group might be, we'll say, you can take it in a lot of different forms. Let's just say Russians, since that's very hot right now. So Russians are the out-group. And there's a body of work that really is designed to sort of exploring how in-groups and out-groups interact. And people who know my work will know that I'm very keen on reinventing the wheel. I sometimes don't sit down and exhaustively review all the literature. I just kind of plunge in and try and do something. And so that's what I kind of took this framework and approached the subject, you know, trying to do it in kind of a really with fresh eyes.
So continuing on the in-group and out-group concept, in your opinion, how do movements become more extreme in conjunction with in-groups and the need for legitimacy, excuse me?
So there's it's a surprisingly long process. You know, what I found, I suppose this is probably a good time to sort of talk about the big case study in the paper, which is the development of Christian Identity. Christian Identity is a virulent, violent white nationalist movement, but it emerged from a movement called British Israelism. And British Israelism started in the late 1800s, and it was really, in many ways, seemed like a kind of harmless thing. It was a historical conspiracy theory that said that British people were the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. So it was a way to sort of elevate, you know, put some status, some prestige on British people in a religious kind of context. But it wasn't, that was all it did at the beginning. And so what I found over the course of looking at this was really kind of this journey of what happens when you define an identity, define an in-group as an identity. And when you start identifying yourself as part of an identity collective, that's usually something that's kind of innocuous in a lot of ways. Say I live in Boston. So, you know, I'm a Bostoner, or I live in America, I'm an American, or, you know, often it's geographical, often it's kind of has to do with pragmatic kind of external realities that cause you to group with other people in an identity. And we say we're Christians or we're Muslims, and that's the in-group. That's an in-group that you're creating. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. In-groups and these process of asserting an identity are really, as I argue in the paper, it's about legitimacy. And when I say legitimacy, what I mean is it's about the right to exist as an identity collective. So you're saying, well, you know, we're from Boston and being a Boston person is an identity we can assert. Or you say, you know, we're Irish or we're Italian or we're white or black. And once you assert that identity, you start looking for reasons to justify why it's okay for you to have that identity. So what we see happening over the course of time with British Israelism is that sometimes when you have that initial identity, you can get into a cycle of escalation where you start developing elaborate justifications for why you have that identity, and then those justifications form the basis for a demand for more legitimacy. So with the British Israelists, you know, at first they're saying, okay, we're just the lost tribes of Israel. That has kind of implications for people who are Jewish. And at first, the British Israelists were very friendly to Jews. They were just like, well, we're cousins. We're, you know, we're friend. We're going to be reunited someday later on in history, and we all come from the same place, and, you know, it's all good. And over the course of 100 years, what happened was is that Jewish identity became a threat to British Israelist identity. So it was first, it's like not only are the British Israelists are the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel, but we've inherited the covenants that God promised Israel. And then there started to become a strain of thought that said, well, we have inherited those covenants, and Jewish people have not. They've, because of their, you know, actions that are described in the Bible, or because of conspiracy theories that we believe the Jewish people have disqualified themselves from being the chosen people of God and receiving the benefits of these covenants. And that slowly escalated and became more and more virulent until finally the whole movement, which still exists today, but it birthed a major splinter group that was called Christian Identity, and that was virulently anti-Semitic. And it also expanded its out-group. So it wasn't, you know, it started off being anti-Semitic, and then it created a bigger and bigger racial theory that eventually started to encompass all non-white people. So, you know, it started off as being sort of British, Anglo-Saxon, Israel, and then it became Anglo-Saxon and American, and then it became white people in a very broad way. And the out-group also changed, and it expanded. So the out-group was initially Jewish, and then it was black, and then it was all non-white people.
And looking at this way of delegitimizing or demonizing the other on the part of, let's move on to Christian Identity, since you've tracked it towards that movement. What are some of the methods that they used to do this to those they considered part of their out-group?
Basically, you know, I traced this process, I really came up with something that I call the ladder of identity construction. And the concept behind this is that there's a template for defining an identity group. And as an identity group becomes more and more established, it fills in all the blanks, right? So there's like a form, and that form includes beliefs, like what does our group believe? It includes your behavior. How do we, what do we do? I usually refer to this as practices, like what are our practices? How do we, you know, well, how do we do things in Boston? Then it as the identity becomes more established, these definitions expand into the past. So we start talking about, well, what's our history? What did we do in the past? And then what's our expectations about the future? What's our destiny? Are there prophecies? Or do we have analysis? Do we have something that we're shooting for in the future? And then finally, you know, it gets caught up in this kind of intrinsic, there becomes sort of this intrinsic idea of what does it mean to be from Boston? What does it mean to be an Anglo-Saxon if you're in this British Israelist to Christian identity cycle? And there's also a parallel track for the out-group. So the same categories apply to the out-group. And when you're building the in-group identity, all of that is kind of, it's just about legitimizing your own identity. When you start building the out-group, what happens is when you get caught in this cycle of escalation where you're demanding more and more legitimacy, you need more and more latitude to justify your existence, you get to a point where your need for legitimacy has to be satisfied at the expense of the outgroup. And that's my definition of extremism that I put into this paper. So in order to do that, you build an outgroup identity through these narratives, through these ideological texts, and it has all the same categories: beliefs, what do they believe, and all of these categories are subject to error and distortion and manipulation, but the outgroup even more than the in-group, because often the in-group people won't have direct experience with the outgroup. So what do they believe? And then you fill in the gaps, like, this is what we think they believe, and it's kind of malevolent. And then what do they do? What's their current practices? What are their past practices? What do we expect their future practices to be? And that's where you start to get into really kind of dangerous territories, where you start talking about prophecies. You start talking about apocalyptic expectations. And as you build out that outgroup identity, you start associating it with threats. So, you know, it's okay, well, their behavior is, what do we think they do? We think they're involved. In the case of the British Israelists, they came to believe that Jewish people were involved in a conspiracy to take over the world. It came from the very well-known conspiracy tract called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So when you start to fill in the out-group categories, and you start to fill it in with these things that are very dangerous and threatening, then you start to associate the outgroup with a threat. And then that's where the final piece that sort of marks the boundary between being extremist, meaning you have these views that are negative about the outgroup, and being a violent extremist, because then you start thinking you have to do something about this threat. The threat, you can't just coexist. You can't ignore this threat, because this threat is ever deeper and bigger and more cosmic. And so we have to take more and more extreme violent steps to address the threat.
And in this study, you looked at specific texts to gain information on these shared beliefs, shared history, etc. And I was wondering if we could discuss those a bit, because they're very interesting and quite juicy for this topic. That's the best way of describing it.
Yeah, this whole, this approach that I'm using in here, this ladder of identity construction and definition of extremism and definition of radicalization that I put forward in here, they're all derived from reading the texts. So I didn't, go out with kind of a preconceived notion of what this is, what extremism is going to be, and this is what radicalization is going to be, and I didn't have the ladder in my head at the beginning. About halfway through, I started to get the idea of what I wanted to do. So a lot of that is derived from reading the text. And I picked a series of texts that marked moments of transition for the movement, pretty much. So I started with one of the earliest, not the complete earliest, but one of the earliest explanations of this British Israelist concept, which is called Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright. And that's it's a really long kind of pseudo-historical book that just sort of says, here's why Anglo-Saxons are actually the lost tribes of Israel. And then it does a lot of stuff that's derived from reading genealogies in the Bible. It starts off with scripture, and then it also incorporates some history, some real history, and then some fake history, folklore, basically legends and folk tales, to justify this grand argument that Anglo-Saxons are the lost tribes of Israel. There are so many of these texts. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of British Israelist books and pamphlets. It's unbelievable how much of it there is. So I moved forward a bit and started looking at, really in the 1920s, what we saw was you know, there was a rising strain of anti-Semitism in Europe and America related to, but distinct from, you know, the sort of the currents that produced the Nazi Party. And, you know, behind this in a big way was this conspiracy text I mentioned earlier, which is, I think, a lot of people probably have heard of. It's called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it's a forgery that really lays out it's kind of a funny text. It's a critique of modernity, which was actually plagiarized from an earlier writer. So it kind of lists all the things that can go wrong with kind of a modern open representative society. And because, you know, the original writer who wrote the text this was lifted from was pretty astute in diagnosing all the things that could go wrong in a open society. And so Protocols takes all that content and recasts it as these things are going wrong right now. And it's all because of this conspiracy, this Jewish conspiracy, and it attributes it to very directly to that. And the Protocols, you know, really just became this terribly pernicious and widespread influence spreading anti-Semitism. In the early 20th century, it was published in the United States in an English version in 1920. And one of the people who really absorbed its content and worldview was a guy named William Cameron, who was an editor of the Dearborn Independent, which is a newspaper published by Henry Ford, who's a notorious anti-Semite. And it really, that publication really helped popularize the Protocols conspiracy theory in the United States. And Cameron was a British Israelist. So he, you know, his involvement with this helped spread that content into British Israelism. So the British Israelists started to go from, you know, just celebrating their special Anglo-Saxon connection to the Lost Tribes and started saying, well, you know, we're the chosen people and the people who call themselves Jews aren't. And that anti-Semitic strain really started to pervade the movement over the course of time. And so one of the next big texts in there was a book called When, which is longtime listeners will know that I'm very interested in just how dystopian fiction is used in radical movements. And When is a dystopian novel that is based on British Israelism mashed together with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it describes this conspiracy that culminates in the apocalypse and really first articulates an idea that distinguishes Christian identity from British Israelism. And that idea is that the Jews were descended from Satan, literally. Satan, in the form of the serpent, sex with Eve in the Garden of Eden, and produced children who were satanic hybrids of humans and angels. And that those people are the people we know today as Jews. And there's some details I'm glossing over in here because we don't have 6 hours, but that's the basic concept is that, you know, that not only is this Jewish conspiracy trying to take over the world, and it's aligned with the communists, who are at the time the big bad in the global political stage. And, oh, by the way, they're also descended from Satan, literally descended from Satan. And so that really sort of sprung us forward into, you know, what we now know as Christian identity. And that was picked up by people like a preacher named Wesley Swift, who was a very fiery radio preacher in the 50s and 60s, and a anti-government activist named William Gale, who would go on to create a group called Posse Comitatus, which has really seeded a lot of other kinds of extremism. It was based in Christian identity, but it also added a lot of concepts that would later be picked up by sovereign citizens and by anti-government groups of all stripes. And so ultimately, Christian identity found its fullest expression in the Aryan Nations, which was, you know, it sort of reached its peak in the 1980s and 1990s.
I have two questions for you. So you've given us almost a historical background of these texts and then the different ones that have come out originally and then the ones that have preceded them. Are they still prevalently available, and do people attached with Christian identity or any of the more radical groups that view whether it's African Americans or Jews as you know, the other, very much of an out group, that's a nice way of putting it, do they still use these texts?
Yes. So that's a great question. Christian identity adherents are really very enthusiastic archivists, and as are British Israelists. There are still some British Israelists who didn't go in the direction of being full-on racist group. So that movement survives, and Christian identity survives in a somewhat reduced form today from what it used to. And they're very, very enthusiastic archivists. So they have tremendous online repositories of this material, and you know, exactly how much that material bolsters them in the present day is a little bit unclear. But what we kind of saw in the development of this group is that after a while, it became what these older texts said became less important than the fact that they existed. So when you get to the point of Wesley Swift, he would make references to the fact that these texts existed, but he never really delved into them, and he freely reinterpreted them. But they added to this ladder of identity construction because they were available and they were, you know, referenceable, citable. So, you know, when you if you were challenged on something, you go back and say, well, look at what Professor Rand did or Professor Totten did, or, you know, this person and that person. And so this stuff really does continue to exist today, and it helps flesh out this ladder of identity. One quality of the sort of ladder of identity construction is that, you know, it becomes more and more robust over time, and there's a, as it becomes more complex, it provides a more complete solution to the problems you perceive in the world, and that'll be something I'll be talking about in upcoming papers. But you know, the more material you have to work with, the more real the identity becomes.
So would these texts then in the latter model fall under a shared history as a scripture creating the history that this group receives?
The texts are in a way, they're a gateway to that history, but they do actually, that's a really good point. Actually, I kind of wish I'd written it.
There you go. Next paper.
Yeah. And I'm going to have to cite you.
Please, that'll be great. Thank you.
So the texts are sort of a gateway. They're, you know, the ladder of identity construction contains all these categories, and then sort of down the middle of the chart that's in the paper are the sources. And so the sources starts off with fewer sources. It starts off with just sort of history, and then the Bible. These guys understood the Bible as history. And then, you know, they slowly, as the movement's beliefs became more and more complicated and weird, they had to go further and further afield to find sources. So they would go out and find apocryphal books from the Bible, and then they would find weird medieval texts and stuff like that. But that's that's a great point that you just made there, is that, you know, these texts actually, you know, become sort of meta history, I guess is what you would call them, that, you know, the actual history that they convey is the underpinnings of where the beliefs came from, but the history of the texts themselves are kind of a meta history that supports the whole structure. I'm definitely citing you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad, you know, this is part of the Loopcast. We bring ideas into fruition. So in your study, what did you find as some of, let's say, the main strong elements that created extremism within these texts, and then how that reflects within the groups that read the texts and share this history?
So I think based on the reading of this particular movement, I should just preface this by saying that this paper is the first in kind of a series of explorations. So one thing that I've done throughout my career, for better or for worse, is I do a lot of my thinking aloud in public. So I sort of like work through problems by, you know, when I'm tweeting them or posting about them when I haven't completely got to the end of the road. This is a slightly more structured version of that. So this is the first in a series of papers that are going to take this framework and look at a variety of different groups, and then test the conclusions and probably revise some of them. So right now, based on the case study that's in this paper, as well as based on, you know, sort of my broader reading and experience in tracking extremist groups and their propaganda over the course of a lot of years, it seems to me that there's one sort of key element in the escalation of the demand for legitimacy that we see pushing a group toward extremism. It has to do with challenges, and that really kind of reflects in an interesting way on what we've been doing under the rubric of countering violent extremism over the last couple of years. When you challenge, the British Israelists were constantly being challenged from the very beginning. They were really, what they were proposing was really a divergence from Christian theology, which Christian theology at the time held that the covenants that God made with Israel had been basically voided or replaced by Jesus in the New Testament. So it's called replacement theology. So all the covenants in the Old Testament are no longer operative, is what the majority of Christians believed at that time. And the British Israelists were arguing against replacement theology. They were saying, well, no, the covenants still exist, only they're British. And so naturally, this idea got a lot of pushback. And what you can see in the text is that the pushback, when they got pushback, when they were criticized by mainstream scholars, when they're criticized by other people for their beliefs, that prompted them to develop more justifications. And this is, in a way, this is kind of an obvious thing, except in a way it's not. You know, if you say, I believe in, you know, Jesus, I'm a Christian, and I say, well, I think being a Christian is stupid, and then you're going to say, well, here's why being a Christian is good, and you're going to give kind of a, you know, a justification of why you believe what you believe. So if I say specifically that X Christian belief doesn't make any sense, then you might go and research that and come up with a more elaborate justification for why that belief is correct. And so what you can see in the history of these texts, in the progression of these texts, is that these guys would respond to those kinds of criticisms. So they would say, well, you know, this professor, this preacher said that this isn't legitimate because of this, and so here's a more detailed explanation of why our belief is correct. And with each sort of wave of challenges, the group became a bit more extreme, because when you come up, you challenge X assumption, and then I come back and say, well, here's X, Y, and Z justifications, then X, Y, and Z justifications can be used to develop new ideas. So it's like, you know, when I've come up with this great explanation for why, you know, Anglo-Saxons are the lost tribe, and that more detailed explanation opens the door to saying, well, but, you know, people we know today as being Jewish are not descendants, proper descendants of Israel, and they don't inherit the covenants. And so when that gets challenged, then you add another element in, and you come up with a new justification, and then the new justification gives you a new basis for demanding more legitimacy. And so really, I think one of the critical findings in this paper was that direct assaults on legitimacy run the risk of escalating the extremist orientation of the movement. So where that really becomes very relevant, as opposed to being sort of this high-minded academic thought, is when you look at what we've been doing in countering violent extremism since 9/11. We've had a tremendous program of sort of direct assaults on the legitimacy of terrorism. And you know, to some extent, people have, for understandable reasons, fixated a lot on how these movements relate to Islam. more broadly. You know, how is ISIS, you know, the Graham Wood article is, you know, about how Islamic is ISIS. And then, you know, a lot of people who take a different approach from what Wood's saying and say, well, you know, this extremism is normative Islam and making that argument. And then all this stuff, all these back and forth about legitimacy, I think, has helped escalate the extremism in some cases. So I think that you can argue to some extent that, that ISIS may be a product of that. When you, so there's two elements to this. So one is a lot of our rhetoric and our allies and some Muslim governments have attacked Al-Qaeda on the basis that their understanding of Islam was not legitimate. They're not legitimate Muslims. And that can trigger escalation. And then the other element is that you have people on the anti-Muslim fringe in this country, in Europe, who say, oh, this is absolutely, you know, this is absolutely everything that Islam is about, is these guys are exactly expressing Islam. And that, so that feeds their sense of legitimacy, while on the other hand, we're challenging it and forcing them to come up with new justifications. And I think that's a recipe for escalation, and that's something that's very worrisome. And then the flip side of that, of course, is that the people who are trying to, you know, say that Al-Qaeda is representative, or Al-Qaeda or ISIS are representative of normative Islam or normative Muslims, are themselves creating an extremist identity. They're making the out-group ladder for Muslims and then developing their own extremist in-group. So I think, you know, I think that a lot of the conclusion that I came to in reading this, really, as far as how we approach counter-messaging and how we approach maybe de-radicalization efforts, is that it's better to try and undermine the ideology rather than attack it head-on. Because that way, you know, what you end up doing, you have some... Attacking it head-on will dissuade some people, but it will cause others to go further down the road. And so I think that, you know, there's maybe a better way than the kind of ideological combat that you know, one might fear happening under a Trump administration, and that certainly to some extent has happened in previous administrations.
And I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, because this is such a juicy topic with your research, and then, like you said, with other groups that we're dealing with presently. What might be other ways of countering this message and maybe not attacking the legitimacy, but somehow still making individuals realize that they don't want to join that group? I mean, it's such a difficult situation and topic that I always love to debate this, because it's important, but there's like a fine line, as you have mentioned and as your paper has shown, of the way you tackle it, where it almost, if you're not careful, will do the opposite effect of what you actually are trying to do.
Yeah, so I will have two papers coming out probably in June that are the next papers in the series, and what they're going to do is look at some examples of ISIS propaganda, Islamic State propaganda, and to say, you know, how, so taking these pieces of propaganda, how do you program against this? How do you use this linkage concept to undermine things? And, you know, without giving away the entire spoilers, you know, I think that there are ways to undermine the message, that instead of going head on at the legitimacy, you identify some ideas that are presented in this are, you know, when I basically, the papers will sort of take these Islamic State texts and do them as a graph. So, you know, similar to how a social media graph looks, except with concepts, and these are the concepts that are linking. And in the case of the Islamic State propaganda, I sort of expanded this in-group, out-group piece a little bit. So Islamic State has two in-groups. One is the extremist in-group, which is you're a member of the Islamic State. And then the other is the eligible in-group, and that's Sunni Muslims that they're trying to recruit. So when you take the concepts in a speech, and I've already done this for an Ad Nani speech, and that'll be probably the first paper that comes out. What you can see is that he describes each of these groups in ways that are compatible with this sort of ladder structure. But then he links the concepts across groups. So some concepts are standalone concepts. So for instance, Adnani makes a point to say that the Islamic State is courageous. That's a standalone. That's a pendant in a graph, right? You know, if you're drawing a graph, it's just like one quality that just hangs off of the extremist outgroup or extremist in-group, and it doesn't connect to anything else. But he also says that the extremist in-group, meaning the Islamic State, keeps its promises to the eligible in-group, meaning Sunni Muslims. So that connection, you know, when you draw that as a chart, that's, there's a bridge between the extremist in-group and the eligible in-group. And so you can attack those concepts. So instead of wasting a lot of time saying ISIS are cowards, which is a very popular thing to hurl at them, that's a useless piece of messaging because it doesn't connect to the other group really. So you can say that the Islamic State does not keep the promises it made to Sunni Muslims, and you can back that up pretty well, actually, with a lot of factual information. That's a piece of their messaging that is specifically part of their appeal. That's how they're drawing a connection between themselves and the people they want to recruit. And so you can attack those concepts. Dependence can come into play later. So one thing that was kind of interesting is when they describe the outgroup, which from the speech that I was working with was Shia Muslims, you know, they put out a lot of, you know, they're hypocritical, they're treacherous, they're like snakes, you know, there's like a bunch of, you know, basic insults that are also pendants. They're just, just concepts that are just sort of hanging off of the extremist outgroup. So what you can do is connect the extremist in-group, the Islamic State, and use the same things that they're using to attack the out-group. So, you know, take the concepts that they're trying to connect to the out-group, meaning Shia Muslims in this case, and then point it back at them. And then that helps undermine the message that they're trying to put out. So basically, you know, I think that there's the approach that I'm going to be outlining in detail in these next two papers is really one of, you know, can we really be strategic about how we attack these linkages and concepts? Can we identify the concepts that are most important, that have the most ability to bridge between the group and its recruits or the group and the people it's trying to intimidate, and undermine those and not waste a lot of our time and energy on things that go nowhere?
Very interesting. Well, I look forward to reading those because it's very much in my sphere of interest. And I'm sure our listeners, there will be a lot of people that are excited about hearing these new papers coming out too. So to bring it back to the current paper, you're the author. You've done all this work. It's really a big piece of work. I'm sure you spent a ton of time on it. And it does show that you have, because it's really, really interesting. So I highly recommend listeners that are interested in this topic to read it further. But as the author, what would you say are the main takeaways that you want your readers and our listeners to get from this piece of work?
I think, you know, this is in many ways an extended plea to start treating extremism as a discrete field of study and say we can study extremism in a way that transcends, you know, the jihadi box or the white nationalist box and talk about it in a way that is more robust. So, you know, there's a new definition of extremism that's proposed in here that I got some pushback on. You know, I find extremism as the belief that negative acts against an out-group are inseparable from the health of the in-group, that you can't, the in-group can never be healthy without having these negative acts against an out-group. And that radicalization then is understood as the adoption of increasingly negative views about the out-group and increasingly harsh actions that are justified to take against the out-group. So it's a spectrum, and it's not, you know, a frozen moment in time where we say, okay, this is, you're radicalized now. And to me, these definitions are important because they avoid some of the pitfalls of other definitions. So a lot of other definitions are, they're sometimes circular. It's like, well, extremism is the adoption of extreme ideas. That doesn't really help me understand what extremism is. If you look at the Prevent program in the UK, they defined extremism as being counter to mainstream British values. That's a moving target. You know, what does that mean? And it only means something in a particular moment in time. And, you know, what if the British all became Nazis? Would that mean that, you know, they're not extreme because that's mainstream British values? So these definitions that I'm putting forward are difficult. They open up some doors to some kind of difficult conversations. And they, especially at the low levels in the early stages of a group becoming extremism, there's a lot of room for subjective kind of back and forth. But I think they're better than what we have, which is, you know, a lot of conflicting definitions, none of which really kind of get the job done. So that was a very important piece of this for me, was really just to start saying, like, we can talk about this in a way that is not bound to any one ideology, and that there's a common framework that, you know, and this will, the subsequent papers are going to test this. I'm not saying that this is conclusively proven at this point, but I think that this framework can be taken to other kinds of identity extremism, and maybe even kinds of extremism that aren't immediately identifiable as being identity extremism, and be useful and help us understand the progression of these groups and understand the how their ideologies can be undermined and attacked. So,
well, as you said, there's a lot of definitions on extremism and what is radicalization and violent radicalization, and I really enjoyed reading your take on it. And like you said, I'm sure there are people that maybe don't agree, but that is what this field's about. It's to bring ideas out and debate them and try to share and gain understanding on some of these topics that are really hard to get your head around.
Well, it's you know, this is really... I love working on this. You know, I do it because I started doing it just because I was interested in it and not because I thought I was ever going to make a career out of it. And, you know, I continue to be interested in it. But I also, you know, I'll tell you, I started to get bored with kind of the current state of discussion on this. And so this is my effort to sort of really stir the pot a bit and make it more, you know, interesting and relevant, and maybe try and get into some new spaces. And there's going to be quite a bit of work that is going to spin off of this paper. This is really a starting point for a lot of additional work that I would like to do.
Well, that's fantastic news. I'm really excited to hear that. But thank you so much for coming on the show and discussing this new paper and discussing the up and coming research as well. It's left the door open. I hope we can have you back on the Loopcast when some of these other papers come out.
Absolutely. And who's going to interview you about your new CTC?
We'll see. I know. My co-producer has been talking about that. It's going to be interesting to be on the other side of the microphone. So
absolutely. It was a great piece. The whole team did a really good job, and you should definitely be grilled by somebody for an hour on it.
Oh, well, I will let the team know if they don't listen to the show. I will pass on the word to them because they're a great bunch. So send a shout out to them. But thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast.
Always a good pleasure.